Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM. It's time now for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The health insurance exchanges under the Affordable Care Act are set to open next month. What do they mean for the average citizen and will they work? That's on Delmarva Today. First, this news. And welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. What's become known as Obamacare hopes to provide access to affordable health care to millions of uninsured, and it hopes also to bring down the costs of the current $2.8 trillion health care system. Maryland is, of course, one of around 25 or 26 states that has created a state-based health insurance exchange where insurance companies offer competing plans. In Maryland, it's called the Maryland Health Connection. Before, by the way, we get to the specific exchanges, we can't at least ignore what's going on in Capitol Hill. The House is expected to approve a measure today that would repeal Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. House Speaker John Boehner said, "We're going to continue to do everything we can to repeal the president's failed health care law." The president has responded, calling it basically extortion, accusing the Republicans of trying to force issues that have nothing to do with the budget and have nothing to do with the debt. As for the Senate, Majority Leader Harry Reid says not going to happen. They're not going to repeal it. And the president has said he will veto it, as well as, of course, the budget, the resolution that for the budget runs out on September 30th. So we're coming up real fast on all of this. So I want to get some reaction to that. Let me start with you, Mike Prettle. He's, a local attorney, also an attorney with the Urologists Association. And what's your reaction to this, where we are? Do you think it's going to get repealed? Or do you think we're going to have a shutdown? What's your political sense?
No, I think the Republicans are making a big mistake. I think they're going to hurt themselves. They may help the Democrats in the long run. I think they're going to have to back off. I think that Mr. Boehner is in an untenable position, that he's been letting the right wing control his activities for some time, and he made it very clear last week that he doesn't agree with this ploy, but he has to go along with it because he doesn't have the vote. So I think it's going to hurt them badly, and it's just a question of how bad it'll hurt.
We also have with us Dr. Mark Edney. He's a local urologist, also a critic of the ACA. But what do you make of this battle? I mean, aside from the merits of Obamacare and so on, this is the right way to go? What do you think?
As much as it pains me to potentially agree with my friend Mike Prettle, as a matter of political strategy, I'm not sure they're doing the right thing here, because I think there's potential here for damage to the party in the long run. As a matter of policy, absolutely. I mean, I think Obamacare is terrible policy for healthcare. It's terrible policy for the economy. It's a hugely destructive bill. It's a huge government overreach. We'll get into that later. But I think as a matter of policy, yes, I agree. As a matter of political strategy, I'm not so sure. This may ultimately prove to be a mistake.
And we're also joined by Matt Celentano. He's with Healthcare for All, and he's also been involved with working on the health exchanges. Matt, what's your reaction to all of this that's been going on in Capitol Hill?
Well, thanks for having me. I think I agree with Mike. I think it's just kind of, at this point, pandering to politics, because the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. It's going to help millions and millions of American families, and as we start to implement the bill and folks see how it's going to help themselves, people will come around.
And if they decided to vote against this thing, if they defended it, what would it do in terms of the exchanges and the funds, I guess, that would be provided? What kind of impact would that have?
At this point, especially in Maryland, Maryland Health Connection, or our exchange, is going nowhere. I mean, we are less than 2 weeks out from open enrollment. We are one of the most forward-thinking states. We're ready to go. We have navigators getting trained as we speak. There are going to be folks on the ground making sure that folks that do not have health insurance or might have terrible health insurance are going to have options that they have never had before. The Affordable Care Act is maybe the most important piece of social justice legislation in decades, and it's time for us to move forward.
I want to sort of go around here and just focus now on the exchanges themselves. I'm sure at least a couple of people will be making the case for them. But, Mark Prattle, I'll start with you. How do you see these exchanges working? And, you know, there are some people who are critics on the left who say we should just have a single-payer system and get away from all this. The real question being whether or not the market system, the private system, can really handle the kinds of deficiencies that are seen in the distribution of health care. What's your assessment?
Well, my personal feeling, as you probably know, is I do think that a single-payer system is probably the best way to go, but I think it's not going to happen in our market economy. I think this is a very good way to work the market and for government to channel the market into productive measures. And frankly, I disagree with my friend Dr. Edney, but I think we now have an opportunity for the first time ever in my lifetime to have real competition in providing health care insurance and health care expenditures. In the past, we pretty much were stuck with whatever our employer came up with or stuck with what we read about. But now we're going to have, through these exchanges, have an opportunity to compare costs, to make real decisions, the consumer decisions for the first time in deciding what kind of health insurance we want. And I think, I mean, frankly, I am incredibly encouraged by what has happened. I worked with the Healthcare for All group for 15 years. We've been trying to get access, trying to get reform, and I think that day has finally come.
Let me follow up on it. What, Mike, would you convince you that this system is not working, that this new exchange system that they've overhauled just does not work, is not providing the kind of health care that you think is needed?
Well, the opponents have predicted that costs are going to go out of control. I don't see that as happening. Matter of fact, I've just read a half dozen articles this week about how costs are coming down in California, how in Maryland we've at least stabilized and probably going to ultimately reduce cost, even though we're adding additional people. I mean, certainly there are things that are not perfect with the system. And as I've said to my Republican friends since this whole debate began, if the Republicans would just sit down and try to work out some of the details of it rather than oppose the entire system, that I think we would have an opportunity to improve the system. And frankly, that's what's going to happen. That's what always happens with legislation. I mean, the Medicare system has been tweaked every year since it was first put into effect. And most of those tweaks are good and necessary.
Let me ask you this. How many people who don't get health insurance – despite this program, would convince you that maybe this is not the right way to go? Because I know you favor a single payer, but it's just not enough.
Well, no.
Is it 30 million? I mean, what do you think?
Don, I don't think we can answer that question. I think we're certainly not going to have health care for all tomorrow. Okay, what we're going to do is every year we're going to add a few additional millions of people to the healthcare rolls. How long it's going to take to get close to 90-95% of everybody being insured, I don't know. Nobody can predict. Depends how well the system works and how good the changes are that are made to bring it into conformity with what's necessary.
Mark Edley, I want to turn to you. I know you're a critic of them. And my question is not only obviously what your assessment is, and you can tell us briefly, but then the other question is then what is the alternative to this piece of legislation or the alternative to bring down not only health care costs, but ensure that everybody has at least some basic health care?
Well, absolutely. Mike said something very telling. He talked about the exchange, and yes, the government has a role in setting up and protecting a marketplace. We need rules when there's an exchange. But Mike said something very telling. He said the government is now channeling the market, and that's the problem. It's government intervention in what would otherwise be a free market. And people on the left keep saying, well, now we have all this competition in these marketplaces. And sure, there are several companies in Maryland's exchange. There are several states that have only one or two companies. That's not competition because it's a government-defined and a government-prescribed menu that has to be sold in these insurance policies. There are 12 different categories in the essential health benefits. So you have 64-year-old men, they're going to be required maternity care, pediatric dental and vision. It's a one-size-fits-all program. And what the exchange has done is the central planners have turned actuarial science on its head. If you're going to spread risk amongst a population, which is what you need to do if we're going to have affordable health care for everyone, we need to spread risk. And yes, everybody has to pay, but those who are older and sicker are unfortunately going to need to pay a higher amount because they use more health care. But the government doesn't believe that. They've turned that on its head. So there's this an enormous cost shift to the young and healthy. So now we're in a situation where we have to entice young, healthy people who don't use health care that they need to pay an exorbitant amount for their health insurance compared to what they're paying now. In order to participate, in order to balance this whole scheme. And that's the problem that liberals are now running up against, is enticing young, healthy people that they need to buy insurance for too much money for a service that they don't use. And so that's the problem we're up against, and that's the real risk, is that these insurance exchanges just aren't going to gather enough people in order to spread risk, and that is going to drive costs higher, and that's exactly why.
Okay, before we get to the whole time, I want to turn up to Matt Celentano. What about this?
I'd love to chime in here. The fact is, the market is going to dictate how we move forward. And frankly, right now in the state of Maryland, on the individual market, and in some kind of ways the small group market, we basically have one insurer that has about 90% of the market. The insurance exchange, the Maryland Health Connection, already has 13 companies that have provided bids and 45 plans that have been approved by the Maryland Insurance Administration that all came under the estimates that everybody else said it was going to happen. There are options that have never existed. So it's not about accessibility. I mean, I can get on my iPhone right now and find somebody a plan in 15 minutes. The problem is that it's not affordable. So with 45 new plans and 13 different insurance companies, that's competition that Maryland has never seen. And when we spread risk, we talk about pools to make insurance more affordable. When we have the individual mandate, which is coming very shortly, we're going to have so many more healthy folks that are going to be involved in the exchange, which will spread the risk and reduce costs. And that's what it's all about. So when you hear folks on the right side of the aisle talk about how this is going to make insurance more expensive, they're just talking about a very small snippet. We're not talking about the overall landscape that is going to be the Affordable Care Act.
Man, I'm going to turn to you, Mark, I'm going to turn to you because one of the basic principles of insurance company is that you insure those people that you don't have to pay out money for and try to not to insure people who you don't have to pay a lot of money for. Car insurance has a tendency to do that, for example, right? And you want everybody to have car insurance because you get everybody paying in so that those people who don't have accidents are paying for the people who do. Seems to me the healthcare system certainly is a similar fashion. What seems to me what they're trying to do is to emulate that sort of market thing where, okay, if you can get more people in, paying in, then ultimately what you're going to do is you're going to be able to pay for the people who use the healthcare system more, and in the end may even be able to bring down costs. But nonetheless, although this is insurance reform, not a healthcare cost thing. What about that? I mean, that's what the model that they're trying to create.
Well, absolutely.
Right?
And ultimately, that's what we need, is we need many people to participate. The more people that participate, the more you can spread risk and the more things are affordable for everyone. But a couple things. The stick approach, I don't think, is ultimately going to be the most effective, particularly when you have a toothless penalty. My friend on the line touted the individual mandate as if that is going to be powerful enough to get all these young, healthy people into the market. It's not. For the first year, it's $95. What 27-year-old making $35,000 a year in their right mind is going to say, sign me up for this $4,000 thing, even with the subsidies. Sign me up for this thing that's going to at least cost me $2,000 out of pocket and then have all of these copays and deductibles when I can get out of this for $95, and the year after that it's $600. It makes no financial sense for a young, healthy person who doesn't need health care.
Well, the difference is that the 25-year-old is going to be able to stay on their parents' health insurance for at least another year. And also, right, the value of having health insurance far outweighs what the price is. And I think their parents are yelling at them right now.
We hope they are, but that's the problem. We hope they're going to make that value judgment. We just don't know.
Unfortunately, the Republican, the conservative organizations are telling these kids, don't sign up. I mean, both the Heritage Foundation and Americans for Progress are telling young people to wait until you get sick and then sign up, which I think is outrageous. I think it's incredible. And I think the
Republican Party should denounce it. It's a great point also, because the fact is that this comes back to pandering to politics, is that the individual mandate and the idea of an exchange was first developed in the middle of the 80s and early 90s by the Heritage Foundation. So it comes back to just straight up politics. It's not about the policy that's going to help families have a healthier life.
Mark, I want to give you, allow you briefly to respond, and I want to talk about premiums in a moment. Go ahead.
Sure. No, it's not the exchange concept per se that Republicans are against. I mean, an exchange is a fine idea because the healthcare market is complicated. Understanding what you need for yourself and your family and understanding the variety of choices out there is incredibly complicated, and you need a defined marketplace to assess that. The problem we have is the heavy-handed government oversight of, by defining what the supply is and by defining the competition in these exchanges. That's the problem. And all of these rules, these actuarial rules that have been changed, all of these are going to act to keep people out of this exchange where we want to be crowding this exchange. I think the rules are stacked against expansion of participation in these exchanges.
Let me talk a little bit about it. Apparently there are a series of plans, bronze plans, series silver plan, so on. I'm going to turn to Matt here for a moment to outline for us exactly what it is that we're looking at in terms of these various plans.
Well, for the exchange, there are four different levels, like you said, bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. And there's also a couple of catastrophic plans for probably younger folks that aren't going to spend a lot of money on premium. We're talking about maybe less than $100 a month to have some kind of plan to make sure that when they do get sick, inevitably, we call them the young invincibles, they don't get health care because they don't think they need it, and then a car accident on the way to Ocean City for the weekend, and they have $500,000 worth of debt. Over 50% of bankruptcies in Maryland last year were because of failure to be able to pay medical bills. This is an economic issue. It's not just a moral issue. And with these new plans, there's going to be options that have never existed for people before. If you have a job that does not offer you health insurance, you're not going to be able to afford a plan in the current marketplace. The Affordable Care Act provides options for families that has never happened. There are going to be different level of benefits. But what we say all the time is that if you don't have vision, mental, and dental, especially for your children after the Diamante driver tragedy a couple of years ago, you don't have good health insurance. The essential health benefits that have been laid out by the Maryland Health Administration and the Health Connection and the state government are providing a new marketplace that is going to provide the best possible coverage for families. And that's what it's all about.
Let me ask you this, because, I mean, particularly some of the plans, the two plans I've seen a lot of written about are the bronze plan and the silver plan. What's the distinction between the bronze plan and the silver plan, just overall?
It really just comes down to different levels of deductibles and premiums and what you and your family are comfortable
with. So what would be a deductible, say, for bronze as opposed to, say, a silver?
It really depends. I mean, there's 45 different plans. I can't tell you right now. You can go to MarylandHealthConnection.gov, spelled out, and you can find those different options for your family. And you can also call the call center, which is up and running and live, and they will walk you through it. I call them professional handholders in the nicest possible way, and that's 855-642-8572, and they will walk you through every option that's possible for your family.
I want to turn up to premiums. Mark, any thoughts about having these various plans, or is it just
it's under the guise of variety. What he means by variety and what he said is it's just a difference in cost structure. The difference between a bronze, silver, platinum, and gold, they differ only in the actuarial value. So in a bronze plan, the company covers 60% of the actuarial cost between the cost of what it provides. In the silver, it's 70%, and it goes up to 80-90% for a platinum if you want to pay that much for a platinum. That's the difference. We're not talking about a variety of different types of offerings. We're not talking about giving a young, healthy person who is 28, let me get them out of the range of staying on their parents' plan, who's 28 and says, listen, I'm healthy, but I want a high deductible plan with catastrophic coverage because I don't use health care, but I want to avoid a financial disaster. You do not have that choice on this exchange. And I think that's a tragedy. And I think ultimately that's going to be its downfall.
There's three different plans approved by the Maryland Research Administration that are just catastrophic plans for young people. I mean, that's just not true.
How does that get around the essential health benefits?
It doesn't, but you can pay a higher deductible and you can be covered for something, like you just said, a catastrophic injury.
But what if I don't want maternity care? What if I don't want pediatric and dental?
Today you're covered for maternity, whether you know it or not. There are mandates in every Maryland insurance plan that requires the insurance company to provide those services. I don't need maternity.
Why do we need an essential health benefits then to come in to dictate? If everybody's already getting that, why do we need an essential health benefit?
Let me break in here a little and talk about premiums. One of the things that I ran across that there's some caps, so that, for instance, if you make so much money, you can't pay, say, more. I guess it's a family. You can't pay more than, say, 9.5% of the family income. I think if we're an individual, can't pay more than about 8% of the annual income. And obviously, obviously you need some kind of government assistance. I'll turn to Matt first. What about that is in terms of the kind of premium caps we're talking about?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question, and I think that the good doctor said that, you know, that maybe there's not enough teeth to the individual mandate. But what it comes back to is that we have 800,000 folks in the state of Maryland have absolutely no health insurance. We have an additional probably 750,000 to 800,000 that have such horrible health insurance that we would call them basically underinsured but not insured. That's, you know, 1.5 million or so people in the state of 5.5 million that have terrible, terrible coverage out of a state of 5.5 million, and we are the richest state per capita in the entire country. It makes no sense economically. When you have, if you have health insurance in the state of Maryland, you're paying about $1,000 a year to cover the cost of the uninsured. We call it the hidden health care tax. It makes no sense. The Affordable Care Act is going to help change that arc. And yes, there's going to be work to be done to make sure that there's more affordable and we bend the cost curve. But this is a great start, and we need to build upon it.
Mark?
Hi, I agree. 800,000 Marylanders uninsured is unconscionable, and we need to fix that. But Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, our Secretary of DHMH, has said on the record that by 2020, we're only going to hope to cover about 350,000 of those 800,000, less than half, based on the current structure and the current rules. This system is just not designed well enough and it doesn't open up the market enough to really let all these people in.
But the question is, so do we do nothing? Do we repeal? That's
ridiculous. Of course not.
We have to move forward. And like, for example, in 2007, the Maryland General Assembly passed a dollar tobacco tax, which increased the Medicaid rolls to over 100,000 people. We went from 34th in the country to 14th. That was significant progress. And to think that we would not embrace the Affordable Care Act, which will take away half of our uninsured currently, is unconscionable.
Mark, I want to turn to you because the issue of an alternative, right? Because I mentioned that earlier. And so if we brushed away all of the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act stuff, what is it that would bring A, the cost of insurance down, but also B, extend health and coverage to more than just simply the people we have? Because we know that the market is still missing a chunk, something like 47 million, something like that. So what would be the alternative, you think?
The first thing is this. We've been talking for the last 25 minutes about how are we going to give people this expensive insurance product. Why is insurance so expensive? It's so expensive because costs in healthcare are out of control. And this bill does nothing to rein in the out-of-control costs of the healthcare system. There have been, you know, the huge Time article that came out, there's been lots of articles about the pricing structure in healthcare that bears no relationship to what actual costs are and what the cost should be to consumers of goods and services. We've got to address that issue. And I think HSAs, health savings accounts, we have to introduce more consumerism into shopping for our healthcare. If I go to a doctor and they order a test and I have to pay out of my HSA to defray the cost of that test or pay for all of it, I'm going to start asking questions. Do I really need this? Why? And I can decide for myself if I want that test. Right now, there is so little skin in the game for American healthcare consumers, the insurances, third parties, the government, and private insurances are picking up the vast majority of the bill, so it's a free-for-all. As long as you're covered, sure, order the CT, order two of them, I don't care. We have to get out of that. And once we get out of that and we introduce consumerism into the healthcare shopping experience, costs will come down. They have to. The market dictates that it has to. HSAs are a big one. We need the same tax treatment for insurance policies on the individual market that employers get. Employers have a huge advantage to offering health insurance right now through the tax system. Offer that same tax advantage to people shopping on the individual exchange. Medical malpractice reform. My friend Mike denies that that's a significant issue. The CBO has scored that at $50 billion. It's an enormous issue. Defensive medicine is a huge problem. That will contribute to reducing costs. The issue is there are Republican ideas out there. We haven't put them in this big omnibus comprehensive reform. They're therefore Democrats don't listen. If you don't have a big plan that's going to change a sixth of the economy, I don't want to hear it. But these ideas individually will actually, together, create an enormous difference. And, Mark, and my friend here is
Mark, I think you know this. So. Health accounts have been thrown around by the Republicans for years, and the Republicans themselves have rejected it. It just doesn't work. I mean, that's a non-starter. You know, it's not.
Have they been given a chance to work?
No, the Republicans have looked at it and said this isn't going to fly. This isn't going to work politically. It's not going to work economically.
There's a Republican bill in the House right now championing HSAs.
There's Republican bills in every year, but none of them have had any teeth.
Well, let me offer this question, because one of the things that has always struck me about healthcare is that unlike, for instance, car insurance or going out and buying a car, for example, you have lots of ranges, lots of options because, well, you can get a cheaper car, you can get a – right? But when it comes to your own healthcare, you don't have the kind of knowledge that would allow you to determine whether or not you want a cheaper car or a more expensive car. I was always just, you know, if somebody's offering me the $10,000 pacemaker as opposed to the $2,000 one, which one would I really want to have? I mean, and it seems to me that that's, oh, well, I want that one. And that might be the best one to do. So it seems to me as if the market consumer pressure that you're talking about is different. I mean, we just don't have that kind of knowledge, right, Mark?
Well, that's why your physician's there in the exam room to explain to you the difference between A and B. And do you need this? Do you need the catalog? What does this provide? That's why you have the physician is the salesperson for goods and services and healthcare. It needs to educate the patients, work with the patients, and work with families to determine what's best for them. I mean, that's what goes on every day.
Matt, what about you? What do you think?
Well, I just want to point out two things. I mean, I think that health savings accounts, like the good doctor had said before, have a lot of merit, and it can actually help a lot of Marylanders. The problem with health savings account, though, is if you're not relatively affluent and you're not healthy, it actually is a detriment to your overall health care.
Matt, and I got to hold you there because we've come up against our time. We're talking to Matt Celentano. He's with Health Care for All. Also, Mike Prettle. He's an attorney also for the Urologist Association, as well as Dr. Mark Edney, who's a local urologist, also a critic of the Obamacare. We'll be back after this.
Support comes from Robert Thomas Salon, a full-service salon located on 36 Baltimore Ave in Rehoboth Beach. Salon services include haircuts, styles, coloring, Brazilian blowouts, plus skin and nail care. They carry Moroccan oil and Bumble products. For more information, the number is 302-227-3733.
Support comes from Shorebreak Lodge on the ocean block of Wilmington Avenue in Rehoboth. Shorebreak.
And welcome back to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. National Federation of the Blind says there are about 6.6 million people who have not been institutionalized who are sight impaired in this country. The Maryland figure is just over 100,000, and in Delaware, it's around 19,000. And for those who lose their sight, it can be traumatic, ranging from losing a job to the loss of independence, and that once handy computer isn't so handy anymore. Well, 34-year-old Heather Guy, mother of four, and is one such person who once worked full-time for an orthopedic doctor, managing bills and referrals. And she began losing her sight at around age 14 and eventually failed her. Now she has a new connection with the world with Braille displays for her laptop, computer, and iPhone through a program called ICANN Connect. It's a federal program called the National Deaf Blind Equipment Distribution Program. Also in the studio with her is Shannon Wright. She is a deafblind rehabilitation specialist and trainer for the ICANN Connect program. And, well, welcome to the program for those of you. One of the things that attracted me to this story was that we tend not to be aware of people who have, say, sight impaired or have other disabilities. And I wanted to kind of first take a look at that. And Heather, tell me a little bit about your own story. I mean, as I understand it, you began losing your sight about when you were about 14. What was the issue, or what? How did that happen? How did you find out?
I actually have been going I probably had it a lot longer than that. But when I was 14, I went to the eye doctor for a regular eye exam. And he actually done a test on me where he turned the lights out and showed his fingers in front of me, and I could not see them, which I've always noticed that I couldn't see at night. However, I thought it was normal, just thought it was something, hey, it's dark, you know, nobody can see as well. And I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa at that time. I still had 20/20 vision during the day, so it wasn't so dramatic. I did get my driver's license and everything at 16. However, I started, my peripheral vision started getting more and more narrow. And then it gradually got worse when I was 25. I turned in my license, knew I couldn't drive anymore. Now it's like a pinhole. It's about all I can see. So it just, it's gradual. You know, sometimes it's faster for some people. Some people it's slower. Eventually, I guess I will go blind. Hopefully never, but that, you know, that is the stage that, you know, I'm trying to prepare for.
Now, obviously, when you're 14, you sort of have the whole, your whole life ahead of you, right? The teens and all that sort of thing. What was your reaction to the fact that you were, A, that there was this condition, and B, that it could, were you aware that it could actually get really, really bad?
I did know at the time when the local doctor diagnosed me. I then went to Baltimore to Wilmer Eye Institute and got further testing. And then we found out more about it. Devastating. I mean, you know, you want to be as normal as possible, as everybody else is, you know, knowing you can't go out at night and do things, you know, that normal teenagers want to do. There wasn't, I guess at that time, my parents, this was all new to us, so we didn't know where to go to get help, to find out, you know, Braille. I didn't know anything about that until just about a year ago. You don't know how to react. You kind of got to take one day at a time. Then you just try to do as much as you know, possibly can do that would make you feel as normal as everybody else. And until 5 years ago, I felt like I was. And then it drastically changed.
And when your parents finally realized what was happening, what was their reaction? And how do they come about to try to, you know, support you? Obviously, they were, you know, concerned. I assume they were also surprised. Were they aware, by the way, that you had trouble seeing at night before?
My mom did, but not to, you know, the extent of knowing that there was something wrong. Because it wasn't that bad. You know, I'd only ran into one tree in my life. And she just thought I wasn't paying attention. You know, hey, Heather, there's a tree there. Just being a normal kid, just right. In la-la land. But to hear that, no. They had no absolute idea. But my parents are very, very supportive. They still are. They did everything possible. You know, the first thing, their question is, okay, is there surgery? Is there something that we can do, you know, to correct it? And obviously there was not. They take me everywhere. Mm-hmm. They, you know, they do what they would do if I was seven.
Right.
You know, they take me where I need to go, and they're very active in my life.
And now, it's this, as I said, you're a mother of four. Are you married? And
all yes. That?
Okay. So you got a lot of responsibilities there, then.
I mean, oh, yes.
I mean, the kids don't stop just because there's a problem.
No, they don't. my four-year-old especially does not stop. my son actually was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa 2 years ago.
Okay.
So that was hard.
Yeah. So you sort of have to try to sort of deal with that, as it were. Let me talk to Attorney Shannon for just a moment. In your experience, and you know you've dealt with lots of folks, is Heather's experience a common one? Then is it? I mean, and how they react and.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. I mean, there's a range, which I think is also important. I know a lot of your listeners are senior citizens and elderly folks, and they also progressively lose their vision and hearing over time and don't notice it. In Heather's case, luckily, it was recognized, it could be diagnosed, and then it could be managed in kind of a different way than people who subtly lose their vision and hearing. And I work with a range of clients, from those who are like Heather, who are hard of hearing and low vision, all the way to completely deaf and blind people who use tactile sign language to communicate. So there's a wide range.
Mm-hmm. So. And is there a difference? Do you find a difference between those people, say, for instance, who lose their sight over a period of time, as opposed to somebody that's very traumatic? I remember seeing, matter of fact, seeing on television about somebody who was actually older, whose sight just like it didn't completely disappear, but she couldn't focus or something, and it was like virtually overnight. I mean, it was this real shock to the system, as opposed to realizing that there's this process, or is it pretty much the same?
I mean, it really depends. Denial is denial. A lot of people are not ready to lose their vision ever.
Right.
No matter
exactly.
If it's
sure.
overnight or over a period of time. And Heather, luckily for everyone involved in her life, has done a tremendous job preparing for the future. A lot of people don't prepare. Even if they are given a warning, they still say, it's tomorrow, it's next week, it's later. And I always say, when is later? When exactly is later? Because you can't predict later. So it really depends. It deals a lot with the individual. It says their attitude says a lot, how they approach it. Do they kind of take the bull by the horns and say, I know this is going to happen, or it might happen one day, let me get ready, or it's never going to happen. I'm going to sweep it under the rug. I'll deal with it the day when I can't do X or Y anymore. So it depends. It's a sliding scale all over the place. So
now you worked, I guess you worked in an office for a while, and but eventually, how did you determine that it just you couldn't do that anymore?
Working 40 hours a week,
yeah.
I was getting headaches. By the end of the week or by the end of the day at 5 o'clock, I wanted to go home and go to bed and close my eyes because my eyes were just hurting severely.
Mm-hmm.
I started slowing down. I went to 32 hours, trying to cut one day a week out, hoping that would make it better. I was using a CCTV for the last 2 years, mm-hmm. Which is a large magnifier to help me read papers and things,
mm-hmm.
but I was still able to read a computer. It was just getting harder. I got pregnant with my daughter, and I realized it was also to the point where, okay, I can't see the computer anymore. Papers are getting harder. Just general office work was getting to be a little bit too much for me. And at that time, of course, I didn't know Shannon.
Right.
And I didn't have the equipment that I needed to perform my job. So it was just time to give it up to somebody that, you know, could perform it, you know, the way it needed to be done. So I quit. I've been out of work for 5 years.
Okay.
Now, thank God, that in the last year I've gotten the equipment that I've needed for my laptop, for my phone, and I can communicate and do everything that everybody else can do.
Let me ask you about it, because most of us, we for better or for worse, if we work, well, our identities are wrapped up in whatever it is that we do. I mean, people,
right.
When people ask you what you do, you say, I'm so and such and such. And there's like this loss. Did you experience a loss of independence, of identity? I mean, how?
Majorly.
Yeah?
My independence was completely gone. I was a very independent person. When I was 17, 18 years old, you know, I had my own house and drove back and forth to work, been working since I was 14. I did everything on my own. And, you know, you have that independence as far as small as something. I need to run to the store to get a gallon of milk. Or, you know, you're putting food on the table by working 40 hours a week. And you got to pick your kid up from daycare. You want to take them to soccer practice. All of that just, you know, dropped from me. I couldn't do anything. So you go from being outside the home, you know, working 40 hours a week, you know, picking up the kids from daycare, going to the store, you know, school activities, all of those things, and all of a sudden you can't do any of it. Because, okay, I can't drive there. I got to find somebody that can do it. Well, that's not as easy as everybody thinks. And then you're home every day, thinking, oh, well, what is there to do? Because there's only so much cleaning somebody can do, even with four kids. It's hard. It's the way that I describe it. It's like, okay, the world is still going, and you're on the outside looking in. That's the best way that I can describe it, because you can't do what everybody else can do.
I mean, there's a certain depression that sets in at that point. I mean, and how were you able to work through that?
I can honestly say supportive of my family has been the greatest. And having kids, they do keep you busy, so you don't, you know, have the time to sit and think about it. Depression was a very, very big issue. And it still is. It's not, you know, something that ever goes away, because you still have those moments in your life where you think, oh, I wish I could. You kind of have to talk to yourself. It's like Shannon says, you can either be in denial and sit back and, you know, watch your life go by, or you can, you know, dig in and say, I'm going to make the best of it. And I've made the best of it.
Mm-hmm. Did you receive any professional help for it all, or for your
yes.
family as well, and just try
yeah,
to work through this
therapy,
thing?
Yeah, years of therapy, medication.
Okay. Lots of things.
Yeah.
Shannon, is this typical? I mean, in terms of particularly when you...
You know, it...
Particularly the isolation, I guess.
Yeah, the isolation is a huge issue, and it's a huge issue for deafblind people everywhere. There are some pockets of deafblind people in this country associated mostly with employment. You know, deafblind people want to go where they can get jobs. Anybody does. So certainly, but particularly here on the Eastern Shore, everybody's very isolated. There is virtually little to no public transportation available to people. It is a lot of work to get from point A to point B if you can't drive. So isolation is a huge factor. And, you know, but getting Heather reconnected with the internet, with email, with those sorts of things through iCanConnect has been a huge boost to her being able to communicate with anyone anywhere. We all use email every day, use our phone to text message real quick. No big deal. Nope. To her, it's actually a huge deal. And to have that access, I think, has really changed a lot. You know, we talked about her not being employed for the last 5 years, and I actually said to her this morning, now you can get a job. You have all the tools you need. You've gained all the skills you need, and she's ready to go back to work. She can send an email just like the guy sitting next to her. She has a computer screen reading software connected to her Braille display, and she can do just the same thing as the next guy. And that's the goal of this program. The goal of this program is to provide telecommunications equipment to people who need it, who are deaf and blind, and who can't afford, because this is costly equipment, can't afford the expense to purchase it on their own. So it's been great for her, I think. So
yes.
Yeah, Heather, you ready to go back to work?
Yes. Yes, I am.
But by the way, is there a community of folks who are deaf and blind, and do you connect with them, or what's been your experience there?
I have not, mm-hmm. unfortunately. Like I said, in the last year is my only, you know, before I didn't have a lot of the information or the availability to, you know, look up people or anything. I actually, thanks to Shannon, there is one that I do communicate with email, and we talk about books and different things like that, that is deaf and blind, actually has, you know, similar condition that I do. But unfortunately, she's not here on the Eastern Shore.
Yeah.
It would be nice that if somebody would set up, you know, like a...
If somebody got a group. I mean,
yeah,
associate, you know,
right.
I mean,
there are groups. They're just, everybody is so geographically spread out. Mm-hmm. Again, transportation is an issue, getting everybody to the same place. Not everyone communicates like Heather. Most deafblind people that I work with are sign language users, so they use American Sign Language. So Heather doesn't know American Sign Language, right? Heather's a hard of hearing person, so she kind of falls into a different group. So we have all these different communication needs that come into play. We have transportation, we have geographic isolation, and then all of a sudden this support group, which is not such a big deal, becomes a big deal. The Division of Rehabilitation Services, DOORS, here in the state of Maryland, also has set up some of these type of peer support groups. But again, the number of people, the location, we come back to the same issues. And then, of course, funding. There's always the money. The money is always an issue. So
Let me ask you about the equipment and the cost. So through this program, I mean, if I'm someone like Heather, what are the costs involved with something like this?
So this is a program specifically for people who are low income and have combined hearing and vision loss. And if they qualify with the income and eligibility guidelines, the equipment is free of charge. The training is free of charge. I'm the one providing the services. I contract with Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind, who provides this program in the state of Maryland. And I travel the entire state. I serve all the deafblind clients in the entire state of Maryland and actually Washington, D.C. area as well. And the cost to them is free. The Braille displays and the equipment obviously does have a cost, and the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, is the one picking up the tab in this case.
Hmm. By the way, I have to ask you, Heather, so you read Braille. I assume you didn't learn that when you were 14. How long did it take you to learn it? I mean, how difficult is it to learn Braille?
Roughly 6 months.
Is that all, really?
I want to say about 6 months.
That seems really fast, but I mean, because I guess I compare it to like learning, if you were to try to learn like another language, a verbal language, it could take you years, but yeah, go ahead.
Yes, it was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. I've heard that some people don't pick it up as fast, some people pick it up faster. If you don't have a really sensitive touch, I wouldn't say it would probably be
it's
as
true.
Easy.
It's true.
Shannon's a great teacher. I picked it up in about 6 months. I still can say there are some, you know, at grade two, towards the end, that can get a little tricky.
Mm-hmm.
She actually, I think, did one of the hardest things. I actually had to read a Dr. Seuss book.
Oh, okay.
I know that sounds really small. But it's not. all the punctuation and the rhyming and things that are in a Dr. Seuss book. So if I say if you master that, then you can master Braille.
So how does the Braille work? I mean, when you're going along, I guess a lot of us see them, whether it's at bank tellers or the ATMs. How do you know what's on the page?
You start out actually just like you would if you were in kindergarten, mm-hmm. and you're learning your ABCs. I learned one single letter at a time.
Okay.
And then you go, and then for 2 hours you work on the letter, A, and the smallest. I mean, it's just like when you go through school, you do it step by step. And then you go on to the next letter, and then eventually you're reading sentences, and then you go to paragraphs.
Hmm.
And there are two levels of Braille, contracted and uncontracted Braille.
Oh, explain that.
And what Heather's talking about is uncontracted Braille, which is letter for letter, just like we read. And then once you master that and get all your ABCs down, then you move on to contracted Braille. It used to be known as grade 2 or level 2 Braille. And that is basically abbreviation. So one single cell of Braille would equal a whole word sometimes. And so then you learn all these abbreviations, basically, a whole bunch of contractions, as they're known in Braille. And then that's grade 2, level 2, that's contracted Braille. So Heather went through all of level 1 uncontracted, and then all of level 2 contracted Braille. And it's hard. It's a lot to memorize, but she did. She mastered it very quickly.
Yeah. Because I made back a small story for myself. I remember being at a radio station, and there was someone who was a reporter who was blind. And I watched them read on the air. And I was watching them, and I could see their fingers like move across the page. Mm-hmm. And then I would like go back a little to make sure that what they were was on the page, was what they thought it was, and it was actually a remarkable visual experience to see somebody actually read Braille aloud in such a fashion and make it sound as if, you know, they're just like anybody else going over the air.
I don't know if I quite do it that fast.
You're not quite sure yet? We're not going to get you on the air right away? Wait a minute.
No. I'm a lot slower than that at it.
It takes time and practice, a lot of time and a lot of practice.
So what kind of impact then has Heather, has this then had on your life? I mean, obviously you went through a period when you certainly felt isolated. When did you feel as if basically you were beginning to reconnect again?
Probably towards the beginning of the year. I was starting to, first the phone. I got an iPhone back in December. Shannon actually showed me hers, and I had to have it. So I went out and got an iPhone and felt like, oh, wow, I can text again. And I did that. I think probably my husband got more texts in that first month than ever. And it was just kind of dumb stuff, but I just wanted to text. And then I started, I got the computer and had training on the computer. And then, of course, I got the iCan Connect and started doing Braille on the computer. In the last year, my life has changed dramatically. I can, the school system now has a program where you can go on and check your children's grades, weekly. You can get emails telling you when tests are coming up. I know that sounds such a small, but when you're a mom of four, it's sure. Wonderful to be able to keep up with your children's activities. And that's been, a life changer. Plus now I can, get on the internet and look for jobs and send my resume, and it just makes you feel normal. I don't know how else to put it. It just makes you feel like you're just as good as the next person.
Sort of lifts something from off your shoulders, I guess.
Yes, it is. I mean, because you're completely down, and especially now where my youngest has just started school. So I'm at home during the day now by myself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a four-year-old running around to keep me occupied. So
now you got something to
to
keep your attention. We've been talking with Heather Guy. She's a mother of four, also blind, I guess, or certainly sight impaired, with this new gadget, I guess, from iCan Connect, which has connected her to the world. Also, we've had Shannon Wright. She is a deaf-blind rehabilitation specialist who has been working with Heather and connecting to the world. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Delmarva Today is a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Don Rush is the host. Chris Rank is the executive producer and audio engineer. You can listen to this program again on our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. You can also view our program on PAC-14 television and on demand. Visit PAC14.org for full details and schedules.